Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Brent Johnson, welcome back to another episode. As to everybody else, welcome back to another episode of Milkshakes Markets Madness. You are still traveling, but you're always bringing us some quality background settings and your choice of recording locations. So you're still in Argentina. Speaking of Argentina, our fan base loves when we talk about sports. So why not put some emphasis right away on the recent sports action with Argentina's favorite, Lionel Messi?
Yeah, you know, this is kind of incredible, first of all, that Miami even got Messi to go play for them. And I think we talked about this on a couple episodes ago, maybe a month or so ago. I mean, it's a huge deal that they even got him to come play for Miami. And then for it to be played out in the way it played out last night, his first game, he gets in. And then at the 95th minute, he gets a free kick. Like, even if that was all scripted, right, and it was all just totally made up by the league in order to increase attendance or whatever, he still got to kick the ball into the goal. And he did it. Like, and he won. And he won the game for him. It's like a storybook. It is incredible. And I'm a huge sports fan, so I just thought it was an incredible moment.
Well, the video that we shared on Twitter, which was, you know, shared everywhere, of him scoring that goal, it's really funny because I'm even getting a little bit of a goosebump right now thinking about it. Like, there's so much energy in the stadium. The crowd was going mental. You would think it was the World Cup. I think this is really overlooked. I mean, that soccer just is not a big deal in the U.S., especially just in a market, even like Miami, it wasn't really a big deal. And to see that type of electric energy, I think people are really underestimating what this means for the sport of soccer in the U.S. and for the city of Miami.
I agree. And I think part of it is that I think Messi's a genuine guy. I think he just loves playing soccer. And I think he loved the moment. And my son put it really well. My son's not a huge soccer fan either. And, you know, no special relationship to Messi or anything. But he said to me, he said, you know what was really cool, Dad? It was like he looked like he was just really enjoying it. Like, he still got excited. It was a game in the MLS. It wasn't the World Cup. It wasn't the Champions League. But he was still really excited to be out there playing and to kick that ball. And I think that's part of why he's so loved around the world.
You know, the episode last week put a lot of emphasis on the narrative around, you know, what if, well, it had a lot to do with the BRICS, but we really put, I think, a exclamation around the idea that, you know, everyone's calling for the end of the dollar, but do you really appreciate what it means? And so before our, you know, frequent listeners die themselves listening us talk about sports, why don't we shift into markets? And maybe we start with currencies, because last week we saw the dollar hit the lowest of the year. But at the same time, while you are in this travel mode and you're in Argentina, the peso has also experienced a bit of a fall. And one of the points you always make is this idea that make sure you remember this is all a relative game.
Yeah, you know, I've been in Argentina for 10 days. We're coming home on Tuesday. And in the 10 days that I've been here, the Argentinian peso was lost 5% against the dollar. And what I kind of find kind of amazing is we don't necessarily need to beat this BRICS thing to death. But, you know, this part of what I think has led to the dollar weakness this year is this narrative that the BRICS are going to come out with this gold-backed currency and it's going to be a dollar killer. You know, we talked about this a lot last week. But the reality is though, even though the dollar hit its lowest point of the year, whether it was Friday or Monday, is sometime in the last 5 days, it is still up versus China, the Chinese yuan for the year, and it's still up versus the Russian ruble for the year. Now, these are the two countries that are supposed to be the bookends of the BRICS and that are going to be, you know, leading the charge of this gold-backed currency. And, you know, if the dollar's days are done, then why is it up versus Russia and why is it up versus China? You know, and then not only that, but, you know, we talked last week about how we, you know, this whole narrative was was really turbocharged 2 or 3 weeks ago by a tweet from the Russian embassy in Kenya, right? And so many people jumped on it. Well, this week, you know, there's been multiple headlines that have come out and said, no, we're not announcing this in August. It's not even on the agenda. And, you know, now people are starting to walk it back. So it's just, to me, the whole thing is it's very interesting. And, you know, it's something that I enjoy reading about because, you know, this could happen at some point. And you kind of need to be ready for it. But these continued breathless predictions of the dollar's imminent demise, I don't think do anybody any favors. I think you actually got to use your brain a little bit here and use a little reasoned judgment when you see these things.
Well, last week's episode was one of our most viewed so far. So there's clearly some value in that conversation. And while we were kind of back and forth about these currency narratives, the BRICS, you know, the various tweets and headlines and the headline jumping that people also like to do, we did put some emphasis and highlight on Bitcoin and the gold bugs and kind of the narrative they like to drive around all of this. So speaking of precious metals, it's kind of an interesting side story, but there's this article that came out regarding the Psyche asteroid potentially having 10 quintillion dollars worth of metals, and there's a bit of a conquest to reach this asteroid and extract these metals. Have you thought about this? Have you read this? You know, is this kind of more just way out there as much as like the BRICS currency idea is?
To me, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, you of course it's interesting and you kind of have to think about it. And, you know, it's amazing. If you'd have told somebody back in the 60s and 70s when they were watching Star Trek, that a couple decades later, you'd be sitting here, one guy in Argentina, another guy in Puerto Rico, and they'd be talking to each other back and forth, seeing each other on the screen, just like they do in Star Trek, you'd have probably laughed at them, right? And so that's kind of how I see it with these things. You know, it's not going to happen tomorrow. This is no reason to go sell your gold because they're going to start mining asteroids and the supply is going to, you know, move by 10x overnight. But it's possible. I mean, 20, 30, 50, 100 years from now? I mean, you think about the progress we've made in the last 50 to 100 years technologically. I can't rule that out. Won't happen in the next 50 years. So yeah, I think that kind of stuff is interesting. But again, it's not something to build an investment thesis around.
So you're not ruling out us conquering asteroids. What would you rule out currently in the market right now? We've seen a big uptick in conversations around inverted yield curves. Everyone likes to pick their different version of yield curve to watch. Some would say the 10-year and the 3-month is the big one. There's always this historic lag between first inversion and then when recession comes. You haven't really changed your narrative much, which you had at the beginning of the year, that you felt like there'd be a pullback. When you're looking at things like inverted yield curves and maybe the macro picture when you're kind of formulating your view on markets, you know, do you lean heavy towards one or the other? And do you think maybe an indicator like the inverted yield curve and the lag that it has should have been given more emphasis when you were kind of formulating your view on markets this year?
Well, I don't think anything has really changed. And I don't ever really key on just one indicator. I think no matter how great the indicator is, you should never build an investment thesis or a big position based off of one indicator. But when a bunch of indicators start to pile up, then I think you need to pay attention. The one that I think is interesting about the inverted yield curve, and I'd have to go back and to make sure, but I'm pretty sure either at the end of last year or at the beginning of this year, you know, when we were talking about how my thesis was that we would have a pullback at some point, but how could I be wrong? I'm pretty sure at some point I talked about the inverted yield curve, and that while many people use that as a, you know, sure sign of recession, which it typically and almost always is, there's a lag effect. And what people never talk about is that in the first 9 months of an inverted yield curve, equities typically rise. And I used that as one of the reasons for why I could be wrong. And the reality is that's exactly what's happened. Equities have rallied into this inverted yield curve. But what we have now, and I've talked about this a little bit over the last month, but now we have, at the end of December, we had sentiment was really, really low. Well, now sentiment is really, really high. At the end of December, the put-call ratio, you know, was very much in favor of the bulls. Now it is exactly opposite. You know, the put-call ratio is very much in favor of the bears. Now, again, any of these things at all by themselves, they don't mean that much. But when they start to add up, that's when you at least need to be careful. And to me, they're starting to add up. Another one is we saw, you know, the NASDAQ has just dramatically outperformed regular equities. And not just the NASDAQ, but seven stocks. So, you know, we've gone from the FANG to the Magnificent Seven. You know, I kind of love all these little acronyms. But the Magnificent Seven now, they have a bigger market cap than, you know, three or four different entire industries, which is kind of amazing, right, when you think about it. So you look at that, and then you look at the amount of call options that were being bought on the FANG stocks versus, you know, put options. Everything is just very much skewed towards the bull market continuing or the equity rally continuing. And then that combined with the fact that the sentiment on the dollar was very low, and the dollar hit its, you know, yearly low, the low of the year a week ago. To me, it just, there's too many things piled up saying we're due for at least a temporary reversal that I would not be chasing it here. Now, I'm the first one to say, can I be wrong? I can absolutely be wrong, right? But it's just when you're not just focused on making money and you're also focused on protecting capital and you have this many red flags that are popping up, you just have to be cognizant of them. And to me, this is not the time to be a cowboy. To me, this is the time to be prudent. And, you know, I really wish that I would have been more aggressive earlier in the year. We talked about how we could get a rally at the beginning of the year. That's exactly what we got. And then we've had this great rally over the last, you know, call it 5 to 6 weeks or 8 weeks, maybe it is, since mid or early May. But I just don't see the next 3 months being like the last 3 months. Now, could I be wrong? I could absolutely be wrong, but I'd be very careful if you were just now deciding to jump into the equity market.
Well, you said don't be a cowboy, but you're also talking about the Magnificent Seven. So I already have the cowboy theme in mind. I don't know if they did a sequel, but if they did, it would probably have a cheesy title like the Magnificent Eight, which is what you're referring to. There was a combined eight tech-related stocks that have surpassed energy, materials, industrials, financials, and real estate in market cap. Now, I want to put that in context because we're now referencing three different terms that I think are worth a little bit of explanation, even on a first grade level, so the conversation can flow. We're talking market cap, and we're also talking puts and calls. Can you give a little context on what that means? And sure, Especially when you're referencing this put to call ratio.
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought this up because I try as much as possible to talk in normal lingo that everybody can understand. I know one of the problems with finance is it can be a hurdle to understand what people are talking about, and so then that makes people scared or embarrassed, so they don't ask the questions. So I'm actually glad you brought this up. So when we talk about market cap, that's basically just short for market capitalization, and really all that is doing, it's taking the number of shares that are issued times the value of each individual share. You multiply that and you get the total value of the company. So market capitalization, just think of that as the equity valuation or the market valuation of the company. The reason that's important in this context that we were just talking about is we're saying these seven companies are, based on current market prices, these seven companies or eight companies are worth more than these five or six different industries, right? You rattled them off there. So just sit back and think about that. Does it make sense that these seven or eight tech companies are worth more than what were the industries again?
We had energy, materials, industrials, financials, and real estate.
Right. So think about that. So it's worth more than all of the real estate. It's worth more than all the banks. It's worth more than all the energy, that nothing would exist without all the energy. Right. And so when you start adding that up, that's just another, again, by itself, I really don't think it means that much. And on its own, I don't think valuation really means that much right now, especially in this environment we're in. But when you put it in context with all of these other things, do you really think these seven companies are worth more than all of that other things? If someone said to you, you can have all of these eight companies or you can have all of those industries, which would you take? Right? And so that's when you start to say, wow, that's, you know, it's not that these companies are necessarily going to fall apart tomorrow, but it's definitely getting up there, you know, as far as valuation. And again, you want to be careful if you're just now entering. And I would encourage people to reconsider if they were thinking of just now entering.
Yeah, and to give some, I guess, additional context or visualization to that. Let's say for each one of those seven or eight companies, one share of each of their stock was worth a dollar. And in total, there was a billion shares. So you'd have a $1 billion market cap in aggregate across those seven or eight companies. That's not the same as real value that these other industries potentially are providing or creating. It's really kind of a traded market cap. So if suddenly those shares are no longer trading at a dollar and they're trading at 50 cents, just that quickly, you no longer have a $1 billion market cap. You now have $500,000 market cap. And so the point you're making here is the market feels overextended. And although it trades on expectations, maybe those expectations are getting a little over their skis, and how quickly a little bit of a spin the other way could wipe out a lot of asset value for a lot of people who are chasing this market.
Exactly. And the thing about it is if we had a 10 or 15% correction in equities, especially NASDAQ, that would still be a heck of a year that the NASDAQ's had. The NASDAQ's up close to like 40% for the year or something. So if it pulled back 15 or 20%, it's still up 20 to 25%. I mean, that's a great year. So, you know, if that happened, it wouldn't be the end of the world. And so that's kind of when you think about it from here, if the NASDAQ were to go up another 15 or 20%, now it's up 55% for the year, if that happens. I mean, does that seem like a market that you want to be chasing? I'm not saying it can absolutely happen, but just you kind of got to put that in context and consider how many times we've had a 50% return in the NASDAQ in the last 50 years.
Well, if momentum stocks, particularly in the tech sector, are having the year that they're having, and we use maybe an analogy like a campfire, well, next week we've got Smokey the Bear coming with a bucket of water looking to throw it on the fire. So what do you think another Fed rate hike could potentially do to that momentum?
Well, I think it's largely priced in. I think more than the hike itself, it's going to come down to not only what Powell says, but how Powell says it. You know, the other thing that John, that you and I have talked about a lot is that, you know, Powell has been, for the most part, the very clearly spoken central banker. He's pretty much done everything he said he would do, despite people thinking he would never be able to do it. But even though, like, starting about November, he started to say that he was still going to hike rates, but he wasn't quite as, you know, cavalier about it, and he wasn't quite as forceful, and he wasn't quite as quote-unquote mean, right? He was kind of nice about how he said it. And as a result, I think all year people have been predicting this is the end of the rate hikes. And, you know, with the data softening, it's very possible that we are either at or very close to the end of rate hikes. But what could throw kind of a wrench in the whole rally is if Powell says, you know, we're hiking and everybody kind of expected that, but you know what, we've, despite the recent softening of the data, we believe that we are going to have to hike not just one more time, but two more times, or whatever it is. Maybe he's just more forceful. Maybe he says something, we're only going to hike one more time, but we're not cutting for a very long time. Or, you know, maybe he says something like that. And I think that can start to play with the narrative that not only are they stopping hiking, but I think a lot of people are assuming that they're going to be cutting relatively soon as well. And I think that's where the fireworks could potentially come in. And again, the other thing to remember about this is I'm not saying this is what Powell should do. I think people should stop investing based on what they think should happen. It doesn't matter whether the Fed should or shouldn't do something. Focus on what they're going to do, whether or not they should do it or not. And I think that they're going to hike in July. I think a lot of people agree with that. But as of now, unless things dramatically change, I think they're going to hike again in September. And I'm not sure as many people agree with that. I think a lot of people are thinking that they're hiking in July and that's it. And that could very well be it. But I don't think that the Fed is necessarily on board with that yet.
So speaking of focusing more on what they could do or at least forecasting they will do, are you going to put more emphasis or do you put more emphasis on the jawboning that they do, particularly at a presser after a rate hike? Or are you reading a whole lot into the dot plot? Because there seems to be, you know, various favorites among, you know, economists and what have you.
I probably put more into what Powell is saying, and not only what Powell is saying, but kind of how he's saying it and his overall tone. You know, at the end of the day, these central bankers are very fallible. Their forecasts are not great. So to put a lot of weight on the dot plot, I think is not wise. But, you know, it's another, you know, think about all the times that the central bankers said that, you know, inflation was under control and they weren't going to, it was going to, you know, temper on its own, and they were wrong, and they had to go back on that. So you know, to then turn around and put a bunch of emphasis on their dot plot when their, you know, forecasting track record is not great, I think that would be a little bit of a fool's game. But that's it. I don't think you should ignore the dot plot either. I mean, these are very powerful people, right? They have enormous influence. And if they decide that for political reasons or personal reasons or legacy reasons that they want to crush inflation and they don't care if they have to create a recession to do that, I don't put that past them. And so, you know, I think you have to kind of consider those other factors, those other non-economic factors. We probably shouldn't have to consider those non-economic factors, but I think we do.
All right. Well, speaking of some of those ways that, you know, people can look at, whether it's a dot plot or they're jawboning or what they're doing and what they say they're going to do, one of the ways that markets position for that is, you know, the buying puts or buying calls. And not to, you know, wrap up this week without addressing those two topics, because, you know, you dove into market cap, you gave a good explanation there, but I think it would be valuable in terms of the point you're making about the Fed and you know, future outlooks to speak a little bit or explain a little bit about puts and calls and what that ratio tells you.
Sure. So the put call ratio, if the put call ratio is very high, then that means that a lot of people are buying puts and not many people are buying calls. So you divide one by the other. So if the number is really high, the puts is very high, then a lot of people are buying puts. That means that a lot of people are bearish. They're betting that the market is going to go lower. Now, at the end of the year, that's where the put call ratio was kind of at its highest level in a number of years. Again, that is completely reversed now. Now the put call ratio is very low, which means the puts are not being purchased as much as the calls are being bought. And if you're buying a put, that is a bearish position. It means you think stocks are going lower. If you're buying a call, that means that you're bullish and you think the prices are going higher. So to think about it, if you buy a put, it gives you an option contract to put that back to whoever you bought it from. It's a put, so you put the price back at the price you paid, and so you're thinking prices are going to fall, and you're going to put it back at them at the price that you entered. A call option is the exact opposite. A call option is you're buying the option to call that stock at the price you bought at the strike price, and you're hoping it goes higher. And so that's why, again, on its own, the put-call ratio maybe doesn't mean that much. But at the beginning of if we go back to the beginning of the year when the put-call ratio was the highest it's ever been or close to it, and we've seen a tremendous rally, and now we have the exact opposite. Not only do we have the exact opposite in put-call positioning, but we have the exact opposite in sentiment. You know, if the same thing were to, if you believed in that signal then, which has played out very well, then the signal right now is telling you at a minimum to be careful. And if you feel like, you know, that the market's going to go down and you want to benefit from it, this would be a time where it would be more advantageous than it has been previously to do that. And it's because, you know, and the part of the reason that people use puts and calls is because if you use puts and calls, you can't lose more than the premium that you paid for. Think of it like insurance. If you pay $1,000 for your car insurance, you can't lose more than $1,000, right? But if your car gets totaled, you might get $20,000 worth of damages paid for. And so people use that because it's a way to express an opinion on the market but also limiting your risk. Now, I told people a month ago that I was net short for the first time in a very long time. I did that through put options. So I wasn't outright shorting equity positions, but I had enough put contracts that I would be better off, or I would make more money if equities fell than if they rose. Now, equities are about two or three between, well, it depends on which index, anywhere from 1 to 3% higher than when I did that. And so I actually added a few more puts this week when I saw those signals. But the thing is if I'm wrong, I can't lose more than the options that I put out there or the premium that I put out there. And the premium was probably, I don't know, 1 to 1.5% of the overall portfolio total, right? So as those put options have they haven't expired yet, but as we've moved towards expiration, the time value of those options has decreased. And so for me, so I'm probably pretty neutral right now, maybe a little bit net short. But if we were to go out in time, let's say we go out another 2 or 3 months and markets are right where they're at now, as those put options expire, I would no longer have that downside protection. And as they expire, then my long exposure increases again. So I when I go net short, I prefer to do it with options because it's, again, it's a way to control the level of risk. Because if you outright short everything and the market just goes up 30, 40, 50, 60%, you know, you're losing a lot more than your 1% or 2% premium or whatever it is.
So with the calls being more of a long-minded position or options contract, you're comparing the two different situations, one earlier in the year where there was a lot less defense being played to now where there was a lot more defense being played to now where there's a lot more offense being played. And it's kind of one of those ideas, the longer you stay at the party, the more trouble you're ultimately looking for. So I appreciate that explanation, you know, and speaking of keeping the party going, before we wrap up here, you've got a little bit of time left in Argentina. Is there anything that comes to mind when you're reflecting on the trip you had so far or what's left in the trip that you want to share with everybody before we part?
Well, I think probably the one of the biggest impressions I've got since being here is that despite the economic troubles that they have, despite the horrible government, despite the fact that, you know, their currency loses value, everybody seems very happy and everybody seems, you know, relatively well adjusted. Like there's not, you know, a bunch of homeless encampments and nobody's been super mean and everybody's been really nice. And the reality is they've been through this so many times, they've kind of figured out how to deal with it. And so it's funny, I was kind of reminded of that, I think it was Jurassic Park, you know, that line, you know, life finds a way. Like people, you know, black markets figure out a way to exist and people figure out a way to, you know, survive. And that doesn't mean there isn't hardship here. There absolutely is. You know, I will say I'm extremely fortunate. I've been lucky enough to kind of travel all over the world. I've been on just about every continent except for Antarctica. And, you know, I've met all different kinds of people and I've gone on all different kinds of trips. And this is one of the best trips I've ever been on. I mean, it's just been fantastic from beginning to end. The food's been amazing. The people have been amazing. The scenery's been incredible. You know, they've got, you know, cool stuff to do in the cities. They've got amazing nature. We were up in Bariloche, which is kind of the biggest ski town in the Southern Hemisphere. It was raining, so we didn't get a ski. But, you know, it was just really cool to see. And everybody, again, everybody seems to be kind of going on with their life despite their crazy politicians. And, you know, I think that's kind of similar to the U.S. You know, people, you know, even though the politicians continue to make mistakes, you know, people continue to go along with their daily lives. And hopefully we can all figure out how to deal with it as well as the Argentinians have.
Yeah, well, it seems in the U.S. there's a lot more anger. As the saying goes, you know, hard times make strong men, and Argentina has been through a lot of hard times. They've certainly learned how to find gratitude. So hopefully people who are better off can, you know, take a bit of a message from that and find some happiness in what they do have instead of constantly focusing on what they don't have or the potentiality of losing what they do have. And it's good to hear of your journeys and your travels. You did mention Antarctica, but we're a little short on time because it almost makes me want to talk about flat Earth and the ice wall. But we'll just
have to talk about that at some point. We have to address that one.
we'll just leave that as a cliffhanger. All right, Brent. Well, I appreciate it, man.
Perfect.
Thanks for hopping in on your during your trip, sharing all your knowledge, and we appreciate everyone else for joining us. If you are new to the show, please visit milkshakespod.com. There's more information there, or go to our YouTube channel at milkshakespod. There's a whole new set of structure or playlists on our channel. We have a Start Here playlist. We have a the most recent releases playlist. We have a new segment we started doing this week, which was Peak at the Week. We're trying to do midweek updates. All of that content is nicely organized on the channel. So if you're new to any of this conversation or you're just looking to kind of crawl through some previous conversations, and get caught up. It's nicely organized for you there on the channel at Milkshakes Pod. If you want to interact with Brent on Twitter, you can do that at Santiago AU Fund. You can find me on Twitter at John Cutsmita. And I think that will do it for both of us. Thank you again, Brent, and we'll see everybody next week. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.